How would you describe a successful church? Would it have to do with their average attendance? Size of their offering? How many baptisms they've had in the last year or 2 years or 5 years? Some would say a successful church is one in which people come to hear the preacher preach and the teacher teach. And in that setting, pastors are seen as kind of mini theologians, the defenders of the faith, with a particular emphasis on defending, because many of them are more ready to fight than they are to love. They're known more for what they're against than what they're for. Oh, they're fundamentally sound, but you don't want to cross them on matters of doctrine. Some would say that a successful church is filled with people who are spiritually mature, which means they don't drink or chew or go with girls that do, right? For them, success is measured by correct doctrine and adherence to rules. Maybe that sounds good to you, but I ask, is it scriptural? The Bible has a different take on this question. In James chapter 1, verse 27, James writes, "Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this." Here we go. Pay attention. You want to know if your walk with God is acceptable in His sight, this is what He says success looks like. To look after the orphans and widows in their distress, and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. You say, really? Widows and orphans? I don't recall seeing that on any church's attendance board or their annual report. That's what God is looking for. According to Jesus' own words in John 13, 34, and 35, He says, "A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another." That's surprising. The way people are going to recognize that we are truly followers of Jesus isn't the size of Bible that we hold, isn't how often we go to church, isn't how many verses we can memorize and repeat. It's how we treat each other. Whether we have love, not even love for God, love for one another, is the true measurement of disciples of Jesus. Back in the Old Testament, the book of Isaiah, it gets even more specific. In Isaiah chapter 58, God is talking about the religion of the Israelites, the things that they would do. And one of their favorite religious activities was fasting. That's something that Western Christians don't know a whole lot about, I found. But they were very proud of the fact that they fasted certain days and certain times of the year. And God had this to say in verse 6 of Isaiah 58. "Is not this the kind of fasting I have chosen, to loose the chains of injustice and untie the cords of the yoke, to set the oppressed free and break every yoke? Is it not to share your food with the hungry, to provide the poor wanderer with shelter, when you see the naked to clothe him, and not to turn away from your own flesh and blood?" That's what God is looking for. That's what God would call a successful church, or individually a successful Christian. And such service needs to go beyond words. James 2, verses 15 and 16 challenges us. Suppose a brother or sister is without clothes and daily food. If one of you says to them, "Go, I wish you well, keep warm and well fed," but does nothing about his physical needs, what good is it? I mean, this is almost comical, right? You hear a knock at your door, you go, and there is a family that is obviously in need. Maybe it's the winter time and they don't have coats, or you can tell that they're hungry. They're very obviously in need. And you say to them, "Oh, the Lord bless you. May you be warm and well fed," and you slam the door in their face. How much good was that? None. First John 3, verse 17 and 18. If anyone has material possessions and sees his brother in need but has no pity on him, how can the love of God be in him? Dear children, let us not love with words or tongue, but with actions and with truth. If we're going to claim to love other people, it's going to affect what we do. Not just what we think, not just what we believe, not just what we sing on church on Sundays. It's going to affect how we live. Remember when Jesus spoke of the sheep and the goats in Matthew 25. He separated the people. He put the goats on the left and the sheep on the right. And to the goats, he said, "Depart from me into everlasting darkness." But to the sheep, he said, "Well done. Welcome into the happiness of your Lord." What was the difference between the sheep and the goats? Did it matter what church they attended? Did it matter what version of the Bible they read? Jesus said, "I was hungry, and you either fed me or you didn't. I was thirsty, and you either gave me drink or you didn't. I was without clothes, and you either clothed me or you didn't." That was the difference between those two groups. Now, to be fair, there are some churches that only focus on those activities to the neglect of proclaiming the gospel. I don't think that's good either. I think the New Testament pattern of evangelism is a blend of proclaiming the good news and the practical meeting of needs. I like how one author put it. "The music of the believer's selfless actions became the platform for the words of the gospel. It is divine music when believers apply what they profess to the hurts, pains, and sorrows of mankind." Think about that. I believe music is a very powerful tool. It speaks to the soul, doesn't it? I mean, music can do so much for us. And if we think about the music as being our actions, it sets the stage for the message, the words. But if our actions are not appealing, they're never going to hear the message. Loving people is the bottom line of ministry. And as the old saying goes, people don't care how much we know until they know how much we care. When the church fails to live up to its responsibility, though, we abdicate our roles in society. When we fail to meet even the needs of our own people, we're unwittingly driving them out of our churches to find help somewhere else. We might complain about how much the government gives to the needy, but how much are we? We might complain about how secular psychologists and counselors are dispensing advice that goes against the scriptures, but what are we doing for people who need a listening ear? Someone who cares. Someone once went to the famed evangelist D.L. Moody and said, "Moody, I don't like your method of evangelism." Moody said, "Okay, I'm always open to new ideas. What's your method of evangelism?" And the critic said, "Well, I don't have one." And Moody said, "Well, I like mine better than yours." But how often are we like that? We're critical of what other people are doing, but let's give them credit. They're doing something. Is that more than we're doing? As we continue our year-long theme of sharpening our spiritual skills, I'd like to address the skill of meeting needs throughout the month of July. Over the next 4 weeks, we're going to see how to develop the eyes of perception, the heart of compassion, the mind of discernment, and the hands of action. This morning, I want to begin with that first one, developing the eyes of perception, to see with the eyes of Jesus. Did you notice in our songs this morning, "Be thou my vision"? Even that communion hymn, "Break thou the bread of life, dear Lord, to me. Open my eyes so that I may see." We need to be able to see with the eyes of Jesus. And in order to do that, I believe we must look beyond certain things. The first is to look beyond oneself. Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians 10:24, "Nobody should seek his own good, but the good of others." In Philippians 2:4, he adds, "Each of you should look not only to your own interests, but also to the interests of others." Now, he's not saying don't take care of your own needs, because elsewhere in his letters he says you need to take care of your own needs. You need to be responsible for yourself. What he's saying here is don't only be looking at your own needs. Don't only look to your own interests. And until we get our eyes off of ourselves, we're not going to see the needs of others. To be like Jesus, we must be humble. That's one of the words that Jesus used to describe himself. But I think that word humble is often misunderstood. Some people think being humble means, "I'm no good. I can't do anything." Right? "Nobody likes me. Everybody hates me. Think I'll eat some worms." That's not humility. We'll come back to this at another time, but that's actually a subtle side of pride. See, humility isn't thinking less of yourself, it's thinking of yourself less. When we can get our eyes off of ourselves and on to others, we don't really care about how we look. We're not so concerned about the way people perceive us. We're looking at what are their needs. What can I do to help them? Following Christ changes the way we see others. In 2 Corinthians chapter 5, Paul writes in verse 14, "For Christ's love compels us, it motivates us, it drives us, because we are convinced that one died for all, therefore all died. And he died for all, that those who live should no longer live for themselves, but for him who died for them and was raised again." So the first step is getting our eyes off of ourselves and onto Jesus. But it doesn't end there. "So from now on, we regard no one from a worldly point of view. Though we once regarded Christ in this way, we do so no longer." What does it mean to regard someone from a worldly point of view? It's to analyze, to ascertain their worth based on human standards. How wealthy are they? How successful are they? Are they good looking? Are they talented? That's the worldly way of looking at people. But remember, God said in 1 Samuel 16:7, man looks on the outward appearance, the Lord looks on the heart. Another way that we look at people from a worldly point of view is, what can you do for me? We see people as opportunities to enhance myself, or obstacles that get in my way. And when we do that, we really dehumanize them. Now they're just objects instead of people. The truth is, every time we encounter another person, we are encountering the image of God on earth. This is a soul who is created in the image of likeness of God, for whom Christ died. Every single person we encounter, instead of looking at them from a worldly point of view where it's easy to slap a label on them that might be based on where they come from or what political adherence they have or who their favorite ball team is. When we see people for who they truly are, we are developing the eyes of perception. We're looking beyond ourselves. Next, we need to look beyond the obvious. One lesson that I have learned as a first responder is when you go on a medical call, not to be distracted by or lured in by what's called a distracting injury. It's the thing that you notice first, and it might seem really serious, but it may distract you from something that's less obvious but more critical. You know, you may walk in and you see a lot of blood, or you might see a bone protruding, and you think, well, that's the worst thing. No, go through your whole check, because there may be something even more serious that you're not seeing right off the bat. Look beyond the obvious. Because when we only deal with the obvious, we may spend all of our time dealing with symptoms and not really getting to the root problems. In Mark chapter 2, we read of a paralyzed man who was brought to Jesus. And his friends lowered him down through a hole they made in the roof so that they could get him to Jesus. My guess is that if you had stopped and interviewed those guys on the way and said, hey, why are you carrying this guy in a bed? Oh, we're taking him to Jesus. Why are you doing that? So that he can be healed. He's paralyzed, but we believe Jesus can make him walk. He can be strong again. How surprised do you think they were when they successfully got him down to Jesus and Jesus looked at him and said, son, your sins are forgiven. Wait a minute. That's not why we brought him here. We brought him here for you to heal him. Come on, get with it. But Jesus saw beyond the obvious need to a more critical need. Now, we all know what happened. Pharisees had a hissy fit. It's in the Greek. And Jesus said, just to show you that I have the power to forgive sins, I will say, get up from your mat and walk. And then he did. Jesus didn't ignore the obvious need, but he saw beyond it and reached a more critical need, which was his need for forgiveness. Similarly, in Acts chapter 3, Peter and John are going to the temple, going to church, actually going to prayer meeting. They encounter a beggar who can't walk. And when Peter said to him, look at us, I'm sure that guy thought, oh, good, they've got some money. I might be able to eat today. And then Peter says, silver and gold I don't have. And you can just imagine the guy's face just goes, oh, right? Well, so much for that. But Peter went on and said, "But what I do have, I'll give to you in the name of Jesus of Nazareth. Rise up and walk." And as Stuart Briscoe put it, he asked for alms, but he got legs. You'll get that later. Yes, he was healed. He was asking for money. He thought that's what he really needed. What he needed was strength. And that's what Peter gave him through the power of Jesus. Looking beyond the obvious to see what the real needs are. You might be thinking, well, that's fine, but how can I do that? You know, how can little old me see beyond the obvious needs to get to what's really happening inside someone? Well, the Bible gives us some steps to take. In Proverbs chapter 2, verses 3 through 6, we're given the first step. If you call out for insight and cry aloud for understanding, if you look for it as for silver and search for it as for hidden treasure, then you will understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. For the Lord gives wisdom. From his mouth comes knowledge and understanding. Ask for it. Seek it. In James chapter 1 and verse 5, he says, "If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to him." God is the source of wisdom and discernment. And I suspect he is more interested in giving it to us than we are of asking it of him. He wants us to have it, but we need to ask. Paul prayed for the Philippian Christians in Philippians 1:9, "And this is my prayer, that your love may abound more and more in knowledge and depth of insight." Isn't that what we're looking for? Depth of insight. "So that you may be able to discern what is best and may be pure and blameless until the day of Christ, filled with the fruit of righteousness that comes through Jesus Christ to the glory and praise of God." Pray that for yourself. I know some Christians say, "Well, I don't think I should pray for myself. That's kind of selfish." No, when you're praying for the right things, that's very much what you should be doing. Pray for wisdom. Pray for discernment. "God, open my eyes. Let me see as you see." Don't you think he'd be delighted to answer that prayer? I'm sure that he would. Second, we need to take the time to look and listen. See if this is a recurring need. Maybe it's a pattern. Maybe there's something deeper. Maybe this is just a symptom of a larger problem. Don't just listen to what they say. Listen for the tone of how they say it. Watch for facial expressions and body language. Because I guarantee you, 99% of the people you encounter, if you were to ask of them, "Hey, how are you doing?" they would all answer you with the same four-letter word: "Fine." Right? But just the way they say it can indicate if they really mean it or not. Now, that takes time. That takes effort. That's something we're not always willing to give. But that may be what it takes to see beyond the obvious and see what a person's need really is. And then finally, recognize your limitations. You're not going to be able to rescue everybody. You're not going to rescue anybody on your own. Jesus said in John 12:8, "You will always have the poor with you." We're not going to solve all the problems of poverty in this life. You know, you can make a difference for one. And that one can mean a lot. So you don't have to take on the whole world. Just those that God brings along your path. "Lord, help me see beyond the obvious and see what their needs really are." Now you might wonder, how do I decide who to help and who not to help? I mean, you just said I can't help everybody. Am I obligated to give assistance to everybody who asks for it? Do I have to give something to every beggar on a street corner or on the parking lot at Walmart? My answer to that is no. For one, you can't. And for another, there are times where giving them is not really helping them. It may be enabling them to dig a deeper hole for themselves. Say, well, how do I know the difference? Here's where the discernment comes in. Lord, help me see with your eyes. May I hear your Spirit's leading in my life. I'll be honest with you. Most of the time, when I encounter somebody asking for money, I don't feel that urge to do. But boy, when it comes, it's clear. Help this one. And I believe God will do that. I believe God will enable you to help those that He wants you to help. And He'll give you that insight. He'll give you that discernment. It's going to take time. It's going to take spending time with Him and spending time with people. But God will do that if we ask Him to. And then lastly, look beyond the offensive. Let's face it, some people are really hard to be around. It might be the way they look. Might be the way they smell. Might be the way they talk, the way they act. I mean, they might like country music. They might root for the Cubs or the Cardinals. Right? There are a lot of things that may be repulsive to us initially. Maybe you have an issue with tattoos or body piercings, certain styles of hair or clothes. When you see it, it just, you want to turn away. We need to pray that we can look beyond the things that offend us. Maybe it's their lifestyle choices. Maybe it's their political leanings that are in very sharp contrast to what you believe. And the easy thing to do is just avoid. Nope, not going there. In his best-selling book, The Five Love Languages, Gary Chapman calls loving people who are hard to love the greatest challenge of love. Even Jesus said that. Well, yeah, you love people that are like you. Even the Pharisees do that. It's the ones that are really challenging. Ones that we find offensive. So how do we get past that? Again, the Bible gives us several examples of this. In Matthew 8, beginning in verse 1, it says, when Jesus came down from the mountainside, large crowds followed him. A man with leprosy came and knelt before him and said, Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean. Jesus reached out his hand and touched the man. I am willing, he said, be clean. Immediately he was cured of his leprosy. If you haven't seen it yet, I would highly recommend look up this incident in The Chosen. It is powerful. Because you see Jesus walking with his disciples, and here comes this man, and he's got tattered clothes and sores, you could tell. And by law, they were supposed to say, unclean, unclean, and keep people away from him. But this guy is walking toward Jesus. And Peter steps up. He's ready to kill the guy. You stay away from Jesus. Stay away from us. And Jesus says, no, no. Let him come. And he gets closer and he says, Jesus, Jesus, I know you can heal me if you are willing. And Jesus reaches out and touches the man. That's something you didn't do to lepers back then. But Jesus touched him. Now, that's not new for Jesus. I mean, we see all through the Gospels, he'll touch one person or another and heal them. But a leper? Yeah, he did. He wasn't worried about contracting something from the leper. And I want you to notice that Jesus touched him before he healed him. I think that's very, very significant. He didn't have to. Jesus healed a lot of people without touching them, right? I mean, they didn't even have to be there. Guy comes and says, hey, my servant is about to die. Can you come to my... In fact, he says, you don't even have to come to my house. I know if you just say the word, he'll be healed. Jesus said, wow, look at this guy's faith. Yeah, I'll say the word. And when he went back home, the servant was healed. And he said, what time did it happen? It was exactly the same time Jesus said the word. Jesus didn't have to touch this guy. He could have said, you know, stay 100 yards away and be clean. And it would have happened. There's more to it. Because the obvious need was his leprosy. But he had even greater needs than that. Mother Teresa, who spent decades in Calcutta ministering to lepers, said the worst part of leprosy is not physical, it's the disease of being unwanted. I don't know how long this guy in Mark 3 had leprosy. It was probably for years. But however long he had it was how long he had gone without any physical contact. Nobody touches a leper except Jesus. Now, I'm not saying go contract some infectious disease somewhere. But what about people that others wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole for whatever reason? It's amazing how a simple touch can speak volumes and how necessary that is for our mental and emotional lives, not just the physical. Don't be afraid to reach out and touch someone, even if there's something about them that's offensive to you. Maybe the issue is ethnic. In Acts chapter 10, Cornelius is a Gentile, and he calls for Peter and asks him to come. And in verse 27, talking with him, Peter went inside and found a large gathering of people. He said to them, you are well aware that it is against our law for a Jew to associate with Gentile or visit him. But God has shown me not to call any man impure or unclean. So when I was sent for, I came without raising any objection. May I ask why you sent for me? And out of this came the first Gentile convert to Christ. Why? Because he was willing to see beyond what was normally offensive to a Jew, the fact that this man wasn't. Maybe the problem is the person's past. Here we have a combination in the scripture reading this morning. Remember the Samaritan woman at the well? Jesus said, yeah, you're not married. You've had five husbands, and the guy you're living with now, you're not married to. She had two strikes. And yet, he saw beyond the offensive and met a need. And many people came to believe in him through that one that, again, his disciples wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole. Remember the woman caught in the act of adultery in John chapter 8? Jesus had every right to condemn her. He was the only one that did. But he said, I don't condemn you. Go and sin no more. In Acts chapter 9, after Saul of Tarsus had this vision of Jesus and was converted to Christ, he runs into a problem. Verse 26 says, when he came to Jerusalem, he tried to join the apostles, but they were all afraid of him, not believing he was really a disciple. It's hard for us to imagine, but if you could imagine, you know, the number one persecutor of Christians who was responsible for the arrest, detention, even death of Christians, now he comes along and says, oh, hey, guys, I'm one of you now. We'd all be going like, yeah, right. And that's exactly what the disciples did. But Barnabas took him and brought him to the apostles. He told them how Saul on his journey had seen the Lord and the Lord had spoken to him, and how in Damascus he had preached fearlessly in the name of Jesus. They didn't want to accept Saul, but Barnabas, son of encouragement, says, you know what, I'll vouch for this guy. I believe in him. He saw something that no one else could. And can you imagine what our New Testament would be if he hadn't? All the letters of Paul gone. Because Barnabas saw what nobody else could. Now you would think that Saul, later known as Paul, would have learned his lesson here. How Barnabas was willing to accept him despite his reputation. But you go a few more chapters in Acts over to chapter 15. Verse 36 says, at some time later, Paul said to Barnabas, let's go back and visit the brothers in all the towns we preach the word of the Lord and see how they're doing. Great idea. Let's follow up. Barnabas says, yeah, let's do it. Let's take John Mark. You know, he went with us the first time. Paul says, yeah, I know he went with us the first time because he quit halfway through. I don't want him. I don't like quitters. I ain't working with quitters. No way. Barnabas says, come on, let's give him another chance. I think it shows a lot of Barnabas' character that he didn't say, hey, don't you remember when I stood up for you with the apostles? You know, he really could have played that card, and he didn't. But he's like, come on, let's give him another chance. Again, Barnabas saw something in John Mark that Paul couldn't see. And it led to those two splitting up. Barnabas took John Mark with him, and they went on a ministry, and Paul took Silas, and they went in another direction. But you know, before it was all said and done, Paul had to admit, yeah, you know that guy Mark, he's all right. He's useful. And by the way, he wrote the second gospel, the Gospel of Mark. So again, what would our New Testament be without Barnabas? Here's a guy who didn't even write a book of the Bible that we know of. But what an impact, because he could see beyond the offensive. If we really want to sharpen the spiritual skill of meeting needs, we must begin with our vision. We need to develop eyes of perception. We need to look beyond ourselves to see others and their needs. We need to recognize that every person is a soul created in the image of God for whom Christ died. We need to look beyond the obvious needs to the deeper ones, distinguishing symptoms from the root causes. Pray for discernment. Take the time to really look and listen and realize our limitations. And then we must look beyond the offensive, whether that's their physical condition, their ethnic or cultural backgrounds, or their past behavior and reputation. See beyond that. That's what Jesus did. That's what his disciples did. That's what we're called to do. And just remember the last words of Jesus in that story of the sheep and the goats in Matthew 25, I tell you the truth, whatever you did for the least of my brothers, you did it to me. Let's see through those eyes.